Hello, and welcome to episode 45 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I'm joined by Meg Jones. Meg and I met at Ed Camp St. Augustine, where she started a conversation about critical literacy. I was really impressed with what she had to say during the discussion in St. Augustine, and so I went up to her afterwards and asked her to join me on the podcast. She is a pre-K through 12th grade technology integration coach, supporting instruction with technology. Meg and I talk about critical literacy, what we can learn from the Parkland students, the importance of reading critically and accepting and understanding biases, the problems with where we are placing the blame in education, and seeing kids as people. I need to apologize for the audio on this. I'm really not sure what happened, but the best I can tell is that the program I used for these conversations was getting glitchy that day and somehow accelerated my audio. Whatever the cause, it didn't happen with future interviews I've done, so I guess it's fixed. I don't know. But if you're someone who listens at an accelerated speed, probably not going to work great on this one. Anytime I talk, it's already accelerated, so it's a little weird. But anyways, sit back and enjoy episode 46 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Meg Jones. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. And today I'm excited because I get to talk to someone that I met at an Ed Camp. And as you probably have heard from other episodes of the show, I'm really excited about Ed Camp on the whole. I love that model. And I was really blown away at Ed Camp St. Augustine to hear Meg Jones talk a little bit about critical literacies and critical digital literacies. And it was just such a great conversation that I went up to her afterwards and I was like, hey, I'd love to talk to you for the podcast. And so here we are, and I'm joined today by Meg. How's it going today?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well. It's been an interesting day here at school. We're doing this right at the school day. My kids walked out like 10 minutes ago. And so we went straight into an interview. So, I'm excited. It's good. I'm good. Can you introduce yourself to my audience a little bit? Tell them who you are and what you're up to.
Sure. Well, I am Meg Jones, and I am a pre-K through 12th grade technology integration coach on the Gulf Coast of Florida here. And I work with children and teachers and administrators on supporting instruction with technology. And notice that I put instruction first because that's the order it should come in. So I always like to put a disclaimer that I am not an IT person. I know just enough to get by, but my main job is really on technology integration and pedagogy because my background is a classroom teacher in intermediate grades and pre-K primary. And then I also am a current PhD student at USF studying literacy practices. So digital literacy, media literacy, critical literacy, and identity development in digital spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I given the climate of our country at this point, it would be hard for me to not start this conversation when you talk about digital identity of students and not start by talking about the students out of Parkland. And we talked a little bit before we recorded, but I want to start there a little bit and kind of get, as someone who's studying digital literacy and critical literacy, where that connects for you.
Yeah, I guess I really want to get into that conversation, but start by saying that I'm not an expert. Anything I say is merely my opinion. I'm studying this right now. But coming from just my perspective and my interpretation of the current events right now, what we're seeing is development of youth identity in real time. I mean, we've unfortunately been through situations like Parkland before. We've already had situations after as that we're facing, but what's unique right now is that these, you know, teenagers who otherwise have had this narrative about them of being passive and don't care about society, they've created a national movement with minimal help from adults. In fact, facing, you know, adults who are telling them to get back in their place, to get back in their seats in the classroom. And so, It's a really powerful time to sit back. Well, I don't really like to say sit back. I would like to take action and be a co-conspirator with them. But just to observe these youth creating their own places right now in society. And it gives me goosebumps as an educator because, you know, school is about the basics, but it's also about becoming a citizen. And I think we're seeing that in real time right now with with these, I don't want to say kids anymore because they're not kids, with these young adults.
You know, I think that teenagers overall, I was actually listening to, I don't know if you're familiar with My Chemical Romance. I'm going way back to like the emo days now, right? And there was a song called, they had a song out on the Black Parade called Teenagers. And it really, you know, it was just this like, oh, teenagers are horrible. And there really is, there's just always this cultural narrative of teenagers having, you know, just nothing but rude things to say. Their noses are stuck in technology. And it's like, we're seeing these kids rewrite this entire identity of themselves in society right now. And it's phenomenal. And they're doing things that adults couldn't manage to do. You know, we talk about critical perspectives on what's happening. And looking at what is not represented in social media and in the conversation surrounding these issues. And these young people are bringing in those perspectives. You know, they're reaching out to the kids in the schools and the families who aren't normally represented in mass media after events like Parkland happen. And they're saying, they're bringing them into their movement as well. And so they're creating identities that I think some of us adults can only dream of creating through digital spaces, through things like Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat. So it's amazing to see in real time.
It is. It's been a fascinating experience for me. And I don't know if you connect to this in the same way, but I connect to it so much in the connecting to what the students in Parkland are doing and then talking to my own students in high school about it, who are mostly seniors at this point in high school. And like they're interested in it, but they don't have the excitement about it like I imagine I would want them to. But then I've also talked about how I would like to imagine that that's how my students would handle it. As someone who teaches my students to use their voice, and my students run a podcast that's publicly available, and this is the kind of stuff they do, that they would have somewhat of a platform built for that. And I would like to believe that that's how they might respond. And it's been interesting to see these shining examples of what teenagers are capable of compared with where my kids are at and where other students may be.
Yeah, I do think that that we're seeing a lot of what's happening in, you know, with the students from Parkland, because this is now personal. And it's not that it's not personal for students right now, for children right now in school. It's not that it's not personal for adults and educators. But I do think there's some level of, I want to say just, you know, distance with kids in other schools. But it's, you know, I think there's also a parallel in that we're also seeing, and I don't know if you're experiencing this in your school, in your classes with your kids, but we're also seeing kids feel really close to the events in Parkland and express anxieties and fear in some ways that may not be the best in school settings. You know, we're seeing some behaviors and actions that it's just them simply processing. And in that way, I think that kids walk down halls at their own schools and say, wow, this could happen to me. But as far as taking action and becoming a national spokesperson for this, I think there is still some distance with the kids, maybe in your classroom and the kids in my district, where they're like, well, maybe this couldn't happen to me. And so where does my voice really belong?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I even today, so I, today as we're recording this was March 14th, and it's the National Walkout Day. And we had an event at our school, which was significantly more of a remembrance event than a protest. But a lot of our student government members knew the SGA at Stoneman Douglas because there's SGA camps, and we're only a few hours away from there. And so there's like SGA summer camps or whatever. So we actually had some students from Stoneman Douglas come to our school today and speak. And we had a conversation with my students beforehand, and I talked to them about, well, what do you think is going to happen here? What could happen here? What kind of change do you want? And they kind of all just agreed, like, well, I don't think our voices are going to make a difference. I don't think we're going to be able to say anything. And it was so sad to me, because I'm like, look at what's happening right now. There's literally people, kids your age, doing exactly that. And yet, as much as I feel that message has resonated, I wonder if that's one of those Twitter echo chamber things where the Twitter teaching community feels that it's changed, but maybe it's not changing on a grander scale like we would like to believe.
You may, yeah, I mean, you may be onto something there.
we may just be more exposed to it because of the platforms that we're using and how we kind of surround ourselves with certain, you know, news feeds and information in social media, specifically Twitter. I mean, that's probably the most prominent one that I use. And maybe it's just a matter of time and they need to see these other youth be successful and then they'll have more belief in themselves. I don't know. That's really interesting to hear, that your kids felt that way. And it kind of hurts. Like I want this to be a moment for all of youth to realize they have a voice, but maybe this is the start of shifting towards that. I don't know.
Yeah, if you assume that Twitter is the front end, then maybe we're seeing the leading indicators on Twitter, and we know it's just still a matter of time, but at least we're seeing the movement in that direction. I like that perspective on it.
Yeah, let's hope it's the beginning of a movement towards that, and maybe it's just that, you know, we're not really, I don't know, I'm not on Snapchat, so I'm not in that realm of where these kids live right now, and that's okay, they need their own space, but I don't know what this looks like in those worlds.
Agreed. Well, before we get into my main questions, I do want to ask a little bit, because I went into your session on critical literacies. Am I right? Am I saying that right? Critical media literacies? Is that what I'm looking for? I forget the phrase.
Yeah, that session we were looking at both kind of a combination of media literacy and critical literacy and how they intersect.
So can you tell me a little bit about what critical literacy is?
Sure. So critical literacy, to give you a quick rundown, it's really asking questions about content. So it's when you hear literacy, it's not just text-based. It's, you know, any, or as we call it, print text. It's any type of media or text. And it's asking, you know, who created this? What were their opinions? What were their motivations in creating this? What was their meaning that they were trying to portray? And what meaning am I interpreting? Who is represented in whatever, you know, content you're looking at? What perspectives are dominant? And then what is, and I think this was the most powerful piece, what is missing? What's been omitted from this text or image or media that I'm sitting here with? And it's really just asking these questions and being aware that everybody has bias. And when we, you know, when authors creators like make things, they always have a certain perspective of their own, and then you bring your own perspective into it, and then that meaning is made almost in like this third space, and just being critical of how all those things work together and not taking things at face value.
Yeah, and the part you said that really really resonated with me when I was in that session was the comment about how often what isn't said or what is omitted is the most important part of what you're reading or consuming. And I thought that was a very interesting, powerful way to phrase that. And it really connected with me.
Yeah. I'm glad that did resonate. I think that's something that I sit with a lot, is questioning what's being left out. And it's not easy to see. It's not easy to identify. Kind of going back real quick to the whole Parkland conversation, when all of this happened, you know, I consider myself a pretty critical consumer of media, but I was looking at the movement of this youth, like, wow, yeah, this is amazing. They're getting their voices out there. And it wasn't until the students in this movement started reaching out to survivors and families of prior school shootings from different cultural backgrounds and bringing those people into this conversation, did I stop and realize, oh my gosh, wow, this, you know, this movement really only had a single perspective, and what's causing it to get so far into the mainstream conversation now? Is it because there is a perspective that was omitted from the movement when it first started? And that is the perspective of certain populations who are traditionally marginalized or disenfranchised. So that omission may have caused this whole movement to take off in the first place. But I'm glad to see the kids were aware of that omission and brought those populations in.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That is really interesting. I didn't notice that part of it, and that's really powerful. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And it's, again, it's that same kind of thing that spoke to me so much about these biases we all have. And we like to pull the, I don't see color thing. And I've been guilty of this myself. You know, we like to say like, well, I don't see color, or I don't look at, you know, students' income or care if they're on free and reduced lunch or whatever. But we have these biases inherently in us that are somewhat unavoidable. But I think it's the awareness of them. It's the accepting that they're there, not acting like we're colorblind, that help you address them, right? I mean, isn't that a kind of a necessary step for us, I feel like?
Yeah. And again, you know, I'm not speaking from any expertise whatsoever, but I do feel that if we can be honest with ourselves and recognize these things that we carry from maybe from our upbringing or the culture that we're surrounded by, just, you know, asking questions of ourselves and allowing and being open to people kind of, calling us out on stuff and, you know, listening to people, when we need to be corrected, if you will. I think that's a big part of being a critical consumer and a critical producer, especially of media right now. You know, we're a lot of us, especially in education, are, you know, we're participants in platforms like Twitter, and we're out there creating media, and how are we being responsible about it? And are we going to make mistakes? Oh my gosh, yes. I'm probably going to say 20 things during this time together that I'm going to regret later. But I hope somebody calls me out on them, because I'm open to becoming, a better person. You know, there's like this slang term right now, being woke, if you will. I probably sound so geeky when I say that, but like, so being woke.
Yeah. I don't think they usually say being woke, if you will. That's not, I don't think that's how they use it.
Let's just be clear. I'm not appropriating that language, because goodness knows I don't sound right saying it. but it's definitely a thing right now. And I've seen a couple conversations in social spaces, and I've also listened to a couple other podcasts that talk about it. And, you know, there's this, I guess it's just, there's this thing about people saying, well, when will I be woke? And it's like, no, you don't ever reach a finish line. You are always trying to become a better person about being aware of perspectives and biases and narratives that exist and how we can break those. But you never perfect it, ever. And I think accepting that is really a big step towards becoming a more critical consumer and producer with literacy and media.
Yeah, and you hit the next thing I wanted to talk about, which was that producer side. It's even more critical that our students understand those biases in themselves when they get to the production side of things, right? Like, we have to teach them to see the biases in others through the consuming portion, where they're consuming other people's work, so that they can recognize those biases and omissions in their own work when they start to be content creators, which I think is a critical goal for a lot of educators right now.
Yeah. I mean, you just summed it up better than I think I ever could. you know, something we talked, I think, a little bit about in that session was how, I'm going to say my generation. I don't like the whole Z and X. I get so lost in all who belongs to which generation. So I'm just going to say the MySpace generation, because I think that gives you a pretty good framework for the age range. So the MySpace generation, if you will, to which I belong, you know, we had some conversations about critically consuming media. Because at that point we were still in web 1.0, and that you kind of logged on and you just watched, or you downloaded, or you read. And it wasn't really till the creation of Web 2.0 that we're in right now, in this participatory type of context, that we had to start considering being critical creators of media and digital content. And I think that, yeah, we need to start, if we aren't already, we need to start having conversations regularly with the kids in our classrooms about, you know, being aware not only of what you consume, but then using that awareness and what you see in that content that already exists out there, and keeping that in mind when you are then creating something, whether it's a meme, or there's a whole world of research on the meanings behind memes and how they work in digital spaces. But, you know, whether it's that or just putting out a Snapchat, what do they call it? A snap, a video. I don't know what it's called. So out of date with the terms.
You don't have your Snap game on point?
Come on. You know, what's funny is I have the app downloaded, and I'm just terrified of creating it. I don't know. I'll stick with Twitter for now. But yeah, so just, just transferring what my generation learned, our generation learned about consuming into more of a production mindset. You know, and you creating podcasts, I applaud you because I think I would just be terrified constantly of, I don't know, messing up somehow. But I love that you kind of put your kids out there in this, this uncomfortable space of being creators and producers and learning from their mistakes, because that's the best thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that. But they really do most of that themselves. Their show is really on them. But you know, the podcasting life is not an easy one. That's for sure. It's a constant battle. And I think that's part of the reason it is so valuable to me and why I was so drawn and pulled in by your session is because as a creator, I know there are probably biases and gaps in what I'm telling. And I want to address those. And I think that's, if I still don't necessarily have those skills as an adult, I really want to make sure that my students do, or at least are in a position where they can learn them. And so I think that's really critical. I think that's great. So I love what you're doing. I loved the session I went to at Ed Camp St. Augustine. A great session. And I definitely, of the sessions I attended, I felt like I got the most out of that one than any of the other ones I was in. So I appreciate that. But I do want to get to my questions because we've been talking and I think we'll probably hit on some of these themes again as we get into the normal questions for my show. And you said you've listened to a couple episodes, so you probably know what's coming, but that's okay. But my first question for all my guests is always, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Yeah, this question.
That's why we start with it, because it's the one that gets people.
You just throw it out there, yeah. Well, so I never answer things in a very straightforward manner, and I'm not going to start today. I think probably one of the biggest things is that we look for the biggest things that are wrong. But that aside, if I had to choose something, I would say that it's not anything that really is having to do with instruction necessarily. It's this blame situation. I think that right now, one of the biggest things that we need to overcome in education, kind of from a meta perspective, is where we're placing the blame for all of the other things that we consider wrong with education. I'm a huge advocate for teachers in the classroom, and I think that they often get forgotten by those who move up and out of the classroom. I am not up from the classroom. I consider myself as a lateral position, but I think that a lot of times teachers, you know, a lot of stuff comes down on their shoulders. And yeah, there are great teachers out there, and there are teachers who need a lot more support. I can't say that there are bad teachers in classrooms, but I think that a lot of times those teachers who need better support and more specific support get labeled as bad teachers. And it just continues this negative narrative about education, about public education specifically, because since I work in a public school district, and that is an internal situation. That is something that we need to address at our district levels and our school levels, because I think that narrative then moves up and up and up until it becomes a national conversation about, look how horrible our teachers are, when it should be about, look at how our teachers need to be supported. And, you know, we have a lot of teachers who come into teaching nowadays without education backgrounds. They're coming in through alternative certification, and they're thrown into a classroom year one. And yeah, they may be content area experts, but they don't know how to communicate that. You know, it's the curse of knowledge. Like, the more you know, the harder it is for you to teach something. And I question, how are we supporting that? How are we supporting teachers with creating classroom cultures that reduce these behaviors we don't want to see with children? And so, yeah, I think that's really my biggest issue with education right now.
So you talked about not blaming the teachers, which I can see. Where is that blame supposed to be then? Where do we need to point that blame? Where is it? Because if we assume that education is broken or something is not working right, or at least it's not what it should be, then someone needs to take a blame, because we can recognize the problem, but we haven't fixed it.
Sure. I mean, I think though that I would shift that from saying, you know, someone or something is to blame, to there are just many, many, many smaller things that need to be corrected. I don't think that there's a band-aid that can fix education, but I also don't really believe that our education system is completely and utterly thrown in the trash broken. I just think that that's a perspective that seems to continue
because there are a ton of little things that are wrong. As far as, you know, kind of where does that blame fall? If I had to start somewhere, it would be with not a person necessarily, although yeah, I won't even get into that conversation. A couple people out there that I might blame, but it's really in our practices of, you know, like I am a district level coach and I work with other coaches in our district, content area coaches, and there's just not enough of us. You know, we talk about class sizes and we talk about how many kids to a teacher, but we don't consider how many teachers to a coach. And we also don't consider who are we placing in coaching positions. You know, I know not necessarily in my district, but I know of other districts where literacy coaches don't even have degrees in reading or literacy. They are working through ed leadership, which is not a specialty in literacy. And so I think the blame really falls in our practices and policies above the classroom. How are administrators keeping up with their content area knowledge? How are we developing effective PD? You know, we constantly talk about how we need to have engaging lessons for kids and how we need to get them out of their seats and we need to shift our teaching practices to, you know, towards more dialogic practices. And then you go to a PD session and what do? You sit and you get. And, you know, adults are learners too. And are we considering at the district level or even at the school-based administrator level, are we considering how adults might learn best? Because as a teacher, you have to constantly be learning. So you are a learner, but we still keep
developing PD in the same way. So I think those are just some small areas to start there. I'm not going to get into the political realm or the funding realm because that's hour long conversations.
Huh? Yeah. Interesting point there about the size. We do think about that class size and that student to teacher ratio, but we don't always think about that coach ratio. And it's interesting because I regularly as a coach say that I teach teachers. You know, I'm still a teacher. I just teach teachers instead of adult or instead of children. And yeah, if you look at my class size, it's me and 150 teachers at this school. You know, that's not a sustainable model in a lot of cases. And it's not like a classroom where, yes, as a classroom teacher, I had 150 students all day, but I had them broken up into groups of 25 an hour at a time. And I don't have that necessarily during the school day. So I agree that size issue is there. It's so many small problems to address. And I think that's a good point there is it's a lot of small problems, but yeah, there definitely needs to be a push outside of education, away from blaming teachers. But what I worry about there is for those of us that are in education, I feel like that blame comment, pushing the blame away from teachers can prevent us from really addressing some of the issues. I feel like teachers are oftentimes very defensive when you try to address concerns that you have with their practice or their classroom decisions and things like that. So how do you address that with your teachers you work with?
Yeah. I mean, you have a very good point in that if there is no blame, I think then where is that responsibility almost? And that's something that comes down to having conversations about who are you here for? When you look out in your classroom, do you see 20 some odd kids who are just walking test scores? Or do you see 20 some odd kids who have names and stories and histories and who you're trying to help grow and encourage to become the next best part of them? It's I don't have the right conversation to share. But I think it's just constantly when I am working with teachers, making sure that through my language and through my modeling, I am reminding them of why we are here. And that is to support the development of children, not to achieve test scores. I've had a lot of teachers come around because of conversations about, you know, just kind of redirecting their focus and their thinking. When I go into coach for instructional practices from, well, how can I do this to get the best test score to more towards, well, how can I do this to support XYZ student in being more comfortable with telling their story. And, you know, it's a slow shift. I think there are teachers in classrooms who maybe have gone into the wrong career, but I don't think that they're bad people because of that. So I guess that's what I mean by the blame. And I also, you know, think that if we, and this again kind of shifts over to political, if we were to remove the high stakes pressure from teachers, that we may not see as many issues with teachers becoming defensive. Because I would be defensive too. I was defensive as a classroom teacher when I knew that my job was on the line. So I can understand why they become like that.
Well, and to add to that, when those 25 or so walking individuals represent paycheck money because of the fact that they also represent test scores, it can be harder to separate those things. You know, we all have our own lives and families we need to get home to and make sure they have a, you know, meal to eat and a roof over their head. And so when you tie that pay to the testing, that makes it harder to deal with as well.
I'm going to agree 100% with you on that. I don't have the solution to it, but I agree. Yeah, I think that there are some people in positions to make decisions who need to remember that we are working with human beings. We are not working on a car model line here, just trying to produce the same item coming out of 12th grade.
Yeah, absolutely. Huh. Well, I don't know that we solved anything, but a lot of good ideas. I like it. I don't know that we fixed it, but I think having the conversation is the first step, right?
I agree. You keep asking that question and you'll get to all the problems in education though.
Eventually, I'm just waiting for somebody to give me the same answer twice. That's really what I'm waiting for. Because we're kind of, you know, 44 or so episodes into the show, nearly a year of the show, and I really have not had a repeat answer for the most part. So.
Well, that should tell you something.
It does. It tells me something unfortunately depressing. So.
Yeah.
But all right, cool. I'm gonna move to my second question and ask you, what is something you are doing that you wish all other teachers would do?
Well, you know, I'm not currently in the classroom, just because of my role, but I do get to get out into classrooms on a pretty much daily basis. So I can't really say it's something that I personally am the only one doing, but it's something that I see teachers who I admire doing. And it kind of ties in with what we were just talking about. And that is seeing kids as people in so many ways. And just remembering, you know, from the little ones, from those little pre-Kers and kindergartners who, oh, they're so cute, but they just want to drive up the wall some days. And just remembering that they are young people trying to develop ways of expressing themselves and working through emotions and figure out how to handle those things. Through our, you know, our intermediate grades and, oh, that teenage turn. You know, I taught fifth grade for a while and I used to joke after Valentine's Day, man. Oh, it's like the boys discovered girls, but they needed to discover deodorant. Like that was just a very interesting time of development. But understanding too that they are trying to find identities in that age range. And yes, they will frustrate you, but they also rely on you as the adult to be that comforting voice and that consistent voice in their lives. Because, you know, there's a lot of kids in our classrooms who don't have that anywhere else. In another session at the Ed Camp that you were at, I don't think you were in it, but we were just talking about, you know, kids and how they can be some days. And, I was sharing a story about a young man I had in fifth grade. We never did hit it off in that whole year. We were at odds with each other the whole year, but I stayed consistent with him in a stern voice that I still believed in him, even if he was a booger. And he is now in high school, and I saw him recently and he came up and said, you know, you've always been my favorite teacher. And I'm like, why? You drove me crazy and I drove you crazy. And he's like, yeah, but
you still never gave up.
And that was really powerful to me because I just saw him as a person trying to find himself. And especially, you know, late middle school, high school, if we can remember that these kids are trying to try on their adult identities at that age, and they are trying to express themselves in ways that matter, even if it's ways we don't agree with, even if it's ways we don't understand, just remembering that they're people and they have feelings and they have bad days and they have good days and they're confused. And I think too, you know, part of the conversation that we had in that media session, that critical literacy session, was also showing our human sides as teachers. You know, I remember many times in my classroom that I was having a bad day and I teared up a couple times because I was having some emotional days and, you know, medical issues with family members, and the kids see it all over your face. And so I think it's important for us to remember that we're teaching people. And there's, so anyways, there's teachers that I work with regularly that I see them doing this. I see them doing this in elementary school and high school, and I see the kids responding to being treated like adults. And these classrooms are just the most amazing classrooms to walk into, because no, they're not perfect. And yes, there's boogers in those classrooms and you can spot them the minute you walk in, but they're smiling and they know that the adult in that room truly cares about them. And so they do put forth effort. And it's what's amazing, believe it or not, is in these classrooms, these teachers, they get the test results, but they're still treating their kids like people. So I think that's really important.
Yeah, I agree. There's been so many times in my career, both in middle school when I was there and now in high school, where teachers will walk into my room or someone will pop in my room, or I'll walk into another teacher's room and just interact with a student. And they'll give you that look like, you can't talk to a kid like that.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm rude or mean or, you know, sarcastic sometimes, but it's because I'm talking to them like a person, not talking down to them, not telling them what to do. I'm goofing off, having a good time, making a kid laugh, like just treating them like people. And I think that's a critical point. And the other thing you talked about there that really hit me is that they are trying to learn who they are. They're trying to develop adult identities and human identities. And the longer we treat them like children, the less time they have to try on those identities around adults and see what those identities feel like around adults. And I think that's a critical point too. I hadn't really thought about before, but you made me think about is like, they're trying out these identities. They want feedback on them. Like we would give them feedback on anything else. I think it's critical that you recognize your students as people and respond to them the way you would respond to a person acting that way.
Yeah, agreed. And that's, you know, I remember when I first came into teaching, you get that sage advice about don't smile till Christmas.
I hate it so much.
Oh yeah. And what kills me about that though is kind of like, you know, you were just saying, these kids are looking for feedback. They are. And you know, when you hear people saying, oh, they're just trying to get a rise out of you. Well, yeah, they are. They're trying to see how their actions affect other people. No, they probably can't articulate that that's what they're doing, but that's what they're doing. And so, you know, if a kid says something that is rude or disrespectful, I think it's perfectly appropriate as the adult in the room, not to yell back or to react emotionally, but to objectively say, well, that, you know, that didn't feel great for me. Can we talk about why you said that? And is it going to work with every kid? Absolutely not. But if you do it over and over and over and over again, then you might actually break down some barriers. And I think too, something I didn't mention before, but you just kind of made me think of, is when you were talking about how you would just, you know, talk to kids like they're people and you get those strange looks. I do think that that adults in education sometimes, some, not all, create more conflict than is necessary. A perfect example of this is, you know, if you're in a school maybe with one-to-one devices and a kid shows up without their iPad charged, I know of schools where that is a disciplinary action. And it creates a conflict when, you know, I run PD for adults, and I can't tell you how many adults show up without their devices charged and are sitting on the side of the room next to a wall outlet. Why aren't we letting, you know, middle schoolers and high schoolers be the same? I understand the conversation about responsibility. I get that. But as an adult, these kids are being disciplined for actions that I see the very adults disciplining them do the very next day. And I just think it's creating more conflict than is necessary. And it's not treating them like people, it's treating them like machines that should just do the same thing over and over again.
I have had the exact same discussion, sometimes about charging, but more often about cell phone use. And I will be, when we first went one-to-one at my school during our summer training sessions, almost every time somebody would talk about like, what about cell phones? Well, first of all, the one-to-one device has nothing to do with cell phones. So nothing's changed there. But second of all, like I would tell them, I'm like, in my classroom, I didn't worry about cell phone usage. If they wanted to use their phone to send a quick message or reply to a Snapchat, that wasn't the end of the world, because as an adult, I have to know when I can and cannot use my phone. And the reality is that no one is expecting me to never touch my cell phone during the day. Like, that's not a thing that anyone expects of me as an adult, and almost no job nowadays is that really the expectation. And I would always say, it's always the one that fought the hardest against me. Like, no, you can't have a cell phone in class. You can't have a cell phone in class. And I would just say, look down. Look at your own desk. Your phone is right there. I can see it. You've looked at it 20 times in the last hour of my training. Like, why are you expecting your students to be any different than that?
Yeah.
So many times I've had to play.
I'm sitting here laughing because it's just not funny, I guess, but I mean, yeah, it's, you're right. It's like, look down. What are you doing right now? Yeah. Wow. It's, I can't say that it's good to hear I'm not the only one fighting that battle, but it's good to hear I'm not alone in that battle.
Yeah, it is. It's one of those things that it's also easy to say when you are the instructional coach who's no longer in the classroom and not dealing with that. And I'm talking about myself as well. Like, it is easier to say that than it sometimes is to do it, because it's not a hard and fast rule. Because in my classroom, when I did that, one of the things that I was very intentional about is if a kid was regularly off task on their phone, then I would address that kid individually and say, hey, you're allowed to use your phone in my class. However, you're using it too much. And here's the evidence. You're missing notes. You're not paying attention. You didn't turn this assignment in. You didn't get this done. Your group had to do all this work. I could point to all those things and say, this is becoming a problem. From now on, I'm going to make a comment if you're on your phone and point out you need to be back on task. Or you maybe lost your phone for a little bit until you can get back and caught up and learn the rules and we can slowly get back into place. But don't start with nothing. Don't give them no leash and then be surprised when they're tugging on it all the time.
Absolutely. And not just, you know, not just tugging on, as you say, or not just kind of, you know, breaking the rule, if you will, and getting their phone out, but also, I think that if you start a class by saying no devices, turn everything off, you have lost the engagement. You've lost them. Because imagine if you are an adult and you walk into a meeting, and now I am guilty of, my phone is glued to my hand, but because I check email, I'm on Twitter, I'm keeping up with my professional life on there. But if I were to walk into a meeting and the person facilitating said, nope, bring your cell phone up here and put it in a basket for the next 2 hours, I would be so disengaged from anything that person had to say after that. And this is, I can't take credit for this line of thought here. This is something that my colleague Dan Koch regularly talks about with our teachers in our district, that, you know, if you have to think as an adult, if I were in this situation, how would I react? And then don't be surprised when the kids react the same way.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, even in college, I dropped courses because the professor said, this is a no electronics classroom. First day of class, I'd get up in the middle of class and walk out. So I understand that. I get that completely. And I think it's sometimes our teachers can lose track of that. So 100%, I'm with you. I think we need to be treating our students like they're people. I think that's really critical. And I think you're definitely on the right track there with that. Wish everybody would. I'm with you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're rocking and rolling. We're 45 minutes or in or so, give or take. And let's see about my last question for you. My last one is my personal favorite. Who is the best teacher you've ever had?
This is actually a pretty easy question for me. I have a lot of people who have influenced me in many ways, a lot of teachers and professors who have changed my life. But I always come back to the same teacher whenever I'm asked this question. And that is, her name is Donna Roberts. And she's no longer teaching. She has since retired. But she was she was my elementary gifted teacher. And so I had her over the course of several years. She taught, I grew up down in the Florida Keys and in the Upper Keys near Key Largo. And she taught down there at one of the elementary schools. And I just remember her so fondly, not because she was easy on me. Oh, no, no. I gave this lady a run for her money. I know I did. but she did everything I think I've talked about so far. She treated me like a person.
And there were days I know that I frustrated her. And there were days where she let me see it on her face. But I always appreciated that because she was a constant adult in my life. And I was one of those kids who needed that constant adult in my life. And I remember her classroom. This is, you know, back in the 90s. I say back in the 90s, we're getting very old. her classroom, before flexible seating was a thing, she had couches and big floor pillows and rugs. And there was never a time that she stood in front of the classroom and taught to us as an entire group. I remember the routine. You would walk in, you would get your notebooks, like, you know, little composition books. She would have goals laid out for you that day. You would go have a little conference with her for a second and she would say, okay, where are you at? What you working on? Okay, go and work. You could work by yourself. You could listen to music if you wanted to. I mean, we had CD players because this was before we still had pagers at this point in our lives. But I just remember she created a classroom environment that was welcoming, challenging, but also rewarding. She valued multimodal responses. So like not just text-based writing at a time before that was really coming into a thing in education. We didn't have a lot of technology in that class, but we had a lot of collaboration. We worked in groups all the time. And she just always believed in us. And I say us, just the group of kids that I came through that class with. And I'm still friends with her to this day. I'm still friends with her over social media. I know her kids who are now all adults with their own kids. And I will just always remember her fondly as an adult who never stopped believing in me, no matter where life took me. You know, later in life, when I got into middle school and high school, I wasn't perfect, made some decisions I shouldn't have, you know, those things we get mad at teenagers for. And I was able to reach out to her and she just listened and she was just always there even after I wasn't in her class anymore. And so I just, yeah, she was my favorite teacher. Absolutely. 100%. I think anybody who had her, would be lucky.
Good. Yeah. I get that. Especially the Mrs. Roberts part. I have, former teachers who I still will not call by their first name, despite the fact that they are now my colleagues where I work and they will always still be. You know, their last name is always what I call them. So I get that. It's really weird. One of my former teachers has been married and her name has changed, but I won't call her by that name because that's not her name to me. She's like, so it's hard for me to accept that. But no, I like that. I like that this teacher had such a profound impact on you and that it was because of her open and caring nature. I think that is representative of where you're at because it, you know, she was so important to you in your formative years. And now your interest and passion is giving the students the skills they need to develop themselves. I think that's a nice little full circle moment for you.
I think so too. And, you know, my only hope when I came into education, and it still continues to be my only hope, is if I can inspire one kid to then continue that cycle, then I'll feel like I've been successful in education.
I think that's a beautiful sentiment. And I think it's probably a great place to wrap this interview up. Despite our audio glitches and everything else, I think we got it all recorded and it was a great conversation. I'm really, really interested in this critical literacy. And I hope my audience will look more into these critical literacies and digital literacies and the way those two things intersect, because it's really fascinating. And as we move further and further forward into a content creation space over content consumption, those are going to be critical skills for our students to understand and be able to manipulate and work with as they go forward in their own lives in the modern world, as it were. So Meg, I really appreciate you joining me. For my audience, where can they find you if they want to reach out and ask more questions?
Sure. I am mostly on Twitter and it's at Mrs. MJ 1218. That's MRSMJ1218.
All right. Excellent. And again, I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Meg, I really appreciate the perspective you give to this topic. I knew nothing about critical literacy before I came to St. Augustine, and you sparked a thirst for learning in me, and I hope you did the same for my audience. If you want to connect with Meg, you can find her on Twitter. She's at Mrs. MJ1218 or on her blog at megjonesfl.wordpress.com. Links, of course, are in the show notes. She is also a regular participant on EdTech After Dark, which is Monday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern as a Twitter chat. It's a really good one to check out on EdTech.
If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Schreffler, and also on Instagram at Brad Schreffler as well. I'm doing a lot more stuff over on Instagram, or at least I'm trying to, so check that out. I love to hear from you guys over there. That's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or you can also check the feedback page on my website, which gives you options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradschreffler.com/feedback. Links for all of that are in the show notes. Until next week, think about the biases you have and how they impact your thoughts. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.